You're listening to the Ayn Rand Institute Live podcast series.
Climate, Energy, and the Environmentalist Movement by Keith Lockage.
So my topic is climate, energy, and the environmentalist movement. For those of you who don't know me, I'm Keith Lockage. I'm a senior fellow at the Ayn Rand Institute, and I wear lots of different hats at ARI, including organizing conferences and writing and editing for our journal, New Ideal. And I have a science background, so I tend to focus on issues of related to science and at the intersection with public policy and that sort of thing. So and we have this Discussing Objectivism series to kind of take a look at issues that are interesting topics to go into, but to have I'm gonna lecture for sort of 20-25 minutes, and then I'll really throw it open to not just to questions, but we can have more of a discussion. Now, I'm actually not going to be speaking too much about climate or energy. My focus is really going to be more on the environmentalist movement. What I wanted to do, all I really wanted to say in about the climate issue is I wanted to start off by noting, I mean, I'm sure you guys have observed this as well, that we're constantly bombarded with claims about the climate issue that just have this apocalyptic character about them. We're told that this is just this planetary emergency, you know, that we're facing a kind of end of the world scenario, right? You've probably seen Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, and I really liked Alex Epstein's comment, we should be calling her Venezuela Ocasio-Cortez. I support, what's that? Well, but I like the Venezuela Ocasio-Cortez, that fits. But, you know, she says all the time, you know, the world is going to end in 12 years if we don't address climate change. And that's not a paraphrase. She literally says the world is going to end in 12 years if we don't address climate change. You've probably seen this Swedish teenager, Greta Thunberg, who's become, you know, she's sort of become a focal point for students demanding that politicians do something about climate change. And she talks about this in these kinds of apocalyptic terms. The house is on fire. So she spoke before the World Economic Forum in Davos. And she says to all these world leaders, she says, I don't want your hope. I don't want you to be hopeful. I want you to panic. I want you to act as if the house is on fire. So, you know, the level of panic and hysteria about this issue seems to be kind of ratcheting up. Now, there's a couple of directions that one could go with talking about an issue like this. One direction would be to get very quickly drawn into the very narrow details of, discussions about the climate models and disasters and you know, the discussions about data sets related to extreme weather events. So you can very kind of quickly narrow the discussion. But there are a lot of good resources available for getting a kind of a more sober and less panic-stricken view on these issues. Alex Epstein's book, The Moral Case for Fossil Fuels, I would recommend that as a good resource, and then there's resources within there that you can point to. What I wanted to do today, and this is what relates it to the theme of discussing objectivism, rather than kind of zooming in on these more narrow details, what I wanted to do is to kind of zoom out and take a broader perspective on this issue. Because I think that's what's really missing on this issue, is that people don't know how to put the climate issue into perspective. We get these dramatic apocalyptic claims, and they seem like just this sort of isolated, scary issue that's going on. And I think a lot of the hysteria and the apocalyptic perspective is fueled by a lack of perspective on the issue. So what does it look like to take a broader perspective on this issue? So one thing that objectivism teaches us is the need to integrate our knowledge, right? not just to look at issues in isolation as separate, disconnected things, but to look for similarities and to connect the dots among broadly related things. So that's what I want to do today with regard to the climate issue, is I want to look for integrations. And in particular, I want to connect the claims that are being made today about climate change to similar sort of end of the world predictions that have been made in the past. So the first point is, this is not anything new. This is not something we've never seen before. These claims that the world is going to end, you know, in 12 years, 10 years, 5 years, we've seen this kind of thing before. And there's a lot that we can learn by looking at the claims that have been made in the past. And I also want to connect this issue, the other kind of integration that I want to make is to connect this issue to philosophical questions about the relationship between man and his environment. And so, in effect, what I'm going to argue by the end of this is that this perspective on climate that we get in the culture, this sort of apocalyptic view, didn't just come out of nowhere, okay? It arose out of a whole intellectual perspective that's been promoted by the environmentalist movement for decades. And it's an intellectual perspective that's fundamentally wrong in many ways. So I want to explore the kind of mistaken philosophical premises out of which this is coming, and then that I think is... So by doing those things, by making those integrations, that is what I think can help us put this issue into perspective. And this is the kind of perspective that's missing. I think, Alex Epstein talks about this in terms of reframing the debate. I think the kinds of things I'm going to talk about are an element or an aspect of ways of reframing the debate. And I think, you know, for those of you who are looking for ammunition, and I'm looking at you, Talbot, because you told me that's exactly what you were looking for. I think these kinds of arguments are the kind of ammunition that could be helpful. So let's start by, as I said, the first thing I want to do is I want to integrate and I want to take a broader perspective. And the first thing I want to do, so what kinds of predictions have we seen that are similar to the claims that we're hearing today about the climate? Well, I think the first place to look is to look at claims that were made in the past about the climate change issue. And this is something, again, that I think Alex Epstein does very well in his book, The Moral Case for Fossil Fuels. So one of the things he does in the book is he goes back 30, 35 years, and he looks at the predictions that people were making then about what we would be seeing today in the climate, right? And what he finds is that the predictions that people were making back then were just as dire and apocalyptic as they are today, and yet the reality has not lived up to that. You know, the computer models 30 years ago were predicting that we would be seeing catastrophic warming by today, okay? What we've actually experienced up to the present has been fairly mild and, you know, in certain ways actually beneficial. And there's a whole discussion in the climate science community about these climate models that they're using to make these predictions, that the models sort of run hot, like they over-predict the warming and they over-predict how sensitive the climate is to the effects of carbon dioxide. And that's just as true of the climate models they're running today as they were of the models in the 80s and 90s. So one thing we can do immediately is we look back and see, you know, they were making these same apocalyptic predictions that by, you know, 2015, by 2020, we would already be seeing runaway catastrophic warming, and we're not seeing it. So 30 years ago, people were saying the world would have ended by today if we didn't immediately adopt the carbon-cutting policies they were advocating back then. And what we've, you know, and this is a point I want to emphasize, what we've been seeing over the past decades is not... That things haven't gone badly. Human life has improved so dramatically by all measures of human well-being. There's a whole literature that's emerged in the last couple of years documenting all the ways that human life has improved. There are these huge books. I don't know if any of you have read Steven Pinker's Enlightenment Now. It's like a, you know, doorstop, and it's packed with huge amounts of data just documenting all the ways in which our lives have improved. And, you know, a lot of it has to do with improvements in things that are related to, you know, what you might think are environmental issues. So, you know, if you look back at the claims that were made about climate 30 years ago, you see sort of this history of failed predictions. Now, so that's the first dot that I want to connect, okay? Now let's go even broader. So this history of failed predictions is not just unique to claims about climate. This is something we see over and over again on other issues as well. And if you go back and you look at the history of the environmentalist movement, what you see is a whole series of these kinds of doomsday predictions that fail to materialize. So let's take a look briefly at another one. So how many of you are familiar with, I'm sure many of you are, but so there in the claims in the 1960s about catastrophic overpopulation, just by show of hands, how many of you, okay, so everybody knows this stuff already. Yeah, so Stanford biologist Paul Ehrlich wrote a best-selling book in 1968 called The Population Bomb, okay? And the basic idea is that the world's population is growing faster than our ability to expand food production. And this is actually an idea that goes back 200 years before that to Thomas Malthus, who wrote in the late 1700s, he wrote about the population. And it's basically a mathematical argument that organisms reproduce in a kind of geometric or exponential way, but food production can only grow in a linear way, and so, you know, they have to clash at some point. And so he was predicting that the world would be over, you know, in the 70s and 80s, right? He actually said in the introduction to his book, just to connect the dots with the kind of the tone and the apocalyptic character that we hear from Ocasio-Cortez and from Greta Thunberg, people that we hear today, it was exactly the same. He said, the battle to feed all of humanity is over. In the 1970s, the world will undergo famines. Hundreds of millions of people are going to starve to death in spite of any crash programs embarked upon now. And, you know, the kinds of policy prescriptions that he was advocating were just as sort of radical as the ones that we're getting today. I mean, he was calling for population control, but I mean, he was even calling for involuntary population control. So he made all these crazy predictions. I mean, apparently he actually once said that he thought it was likely that England would no longer exist by the year 2000. You know, it was just the whole, everybody would starve and the country would just collapse. Now the thing to understand is that Paul Ehrlich was not viewed as some sort of nutcase, right? He was taken just as seriously as all the you know, scientists who are making claims about climate change today. He was taken seriously at the highest levels. And every prediction that he ever made turned out to be completely wrong. Instead of, you know, worldwide famine and death, what we saw in the 1970s was a revolution in food production. So just to concretize just how wrong he was. So in the last 50 years, the world's population has doubled. And according to Ehrlich's perspective, I mean, this was even worse than he was predicting. So, and yet rates of poverty and hunger have actually gone down. Not only has there not been mass starvation, there's been exactly the opposite. There's been dramatic improvement in all measures of human flourishing. So that's another dot to connect. So the claims that they were making in the past about climate completely failed. Claims about overpopulation completely failed. And you see other predictions of, you know, dramatic apocalyptic predictions that are taken seriously and then fail to materialize. There's been a long history of predictions of catastrophic resource depletion, you know, that we're cutting down all the trees because of deforestation. And yet, if you look at the data, it turns out that U.S. forest acreage is actually increasing in the latter half, or in the start of the 21st century, latter half of the 20th century. Now, for the first time since the colonial period, we actually are having more forest acreage than, increasing. You hear these claims about that we're running out of oil. You know, basically, people have been predicting that we're going to run out of oil ever since we first started using oil 150 years ago. And yet, you know, again, if you look at the data, the proven reserves of oil continue to increase, and, you know, they're just vastly greater than the quantities that are consumed each year. Or you see predictions that, you know, pesticides are going to cause epidemic levels of cancer. Our rivers and lakes are going to be destroyed by acid rain. Or, you know, we're all going to die from skin cancer because of the hole in the ozone layer. You know, you see one alarmist doomsday prediction after another. So the first point that I want to emphasize is we don't normally take this kind of perspective. We look at each of these issues in isolation. But one of the things that objectivism teaches us is to connect the dots between these two things and ask ourselves, is there a pattern here? And what can we learn from that pattern, right? So the first point is, not only are the claims that we're hearing about climate change not new, but they're part of a pattern. If you just look at today's headlines, you might get the impression that what we're seeing and what's being claimed is there's this like unique, unprecedented crisis. But if you take a step back and you look at the history of the environmentalist movement, you see this whole litany of crises that have been predicted and then never came to pass. So there's a deep similarity there. Now, what's the implication of that, though? Okay, so the first point that I want to make, I want to be very clear about what I'm not saying here, okay? So I am not arguing that there's been all these claims in the past and the environmentalists have been wrong before, well, so maybe they're wrong now. Okay, that is not the argument I'm making. I don't even think that's an argument. I think that's kind of a non sequitur. What I'm arguing is that by taking a step back and taking this broader perspective, it gives us new questions to ask, and it gives us things to look at that we can learn from. So I think that by exploring these failed predictions from the past, we can try to understand the thinking that went into them. We can try to see if there's something we can learn from that. Is there some basic flaw in the thinking that went into it? Is there some, you know, is it that there's maybe some fundamentally mistaken premise behind the claims that were made in the past? And is that same flawed thinking or same mistaken premises operative in the claims that we're seeing today? And if so, then we can, you know, we can really put those claims into perspective. We can take them less seriously because we understand that there's some erroneous thinking behind it, right? So that's what I want to turn to next. So let's just continue with the Paul Ehrlich example, and let's ask, you know, why was he so wrong in his thinking? You know, if we look back, we've got 50 years of evidence and 50 years of claims that he's made and all this sort of thing. What can we learn from that? Well, I think there's an essential flaw in his perspective, and it's a failure to recognize the power of human reason to transcend the limits of nature. So his whole argument is that the resources that we have available to grow food and that sort of thing are finite in quantity, and there's no way to overcome that finite limitation. So an analogy that Ehrlich and thinkers like him like to use is this analogy of what happens when you put bacteria into a closed petri dish. Have you guys seen this analogy before? So, you know, you take a bunch of bacteria, you stick them in a closed container with a finite food supply, and what happens? Well, they multiply without restraint until they use up their finite food supply, and then they just all die, right? So Paul Ehrlich's view is that the resources that we have to grow food are as limited and as finite as the food in this petri dish, and there's no way, it's not possible to increase food production at a rate that can keep up with the growth rate of living organisms. This is the Malthusian argument. It's just mathematics. There's nothing you can do about it, right? So the idea is that we're constrained by the same limits like as the bacteria in the petri dish. Now, the irony is that Paul Ehrlich was making these predictions at the exact time that this Nobel Prize-winning innovator named Norman Borlaug was revolutionizing agriculture with new technology. So how many of you have heard of Norman Borlaug? Okay, so if you haven't heard of him, go look up his Nobel. He won the Nobel Peace Prize in 1970 for this work. He's someone you should know about because he brought about what's now viewed as a sort of agricultural revolution that led to massive increases in crop yields. Countries like India and Mexico were really struggling with poverty and starvation, you know, with an inability to produce enough food to feed their populations. They adopted these new strains of wheat and new technologies that Borlaug invented or created. In a fairly short time, they completely turned around and went to being self-sufficient in food production. So a country like India, you know, went to being, a wheat exporter. So technological innovation completely changed the game. Now, the broader point is that this is what happens, you know, this was not just sort of like a one-off miracle, like we happen to have this one guy, Norman Borlaug, and that saved things. This is what happens when people are free to trade and profit on a free market. The specialization that occurs with the division of labor is a continuous driver of new innovations that allow us to produce more using fewer resources. And this actually has there's a concept that people use to talk about this now, and it's called decoupling, that our ability to produce things becomes decoupled from the traditional kind of limits, the resource limits that might constrain them. So just to give another example, I found this data point that I thought was interesting. If you look at the history of corn production in the United States, okay, how much corn, you know, does the United States grow every year? Now, so on the kind of bacteria premise, you might think, well, there's a limit to how much corn we can grow, right? It's going to be limited by the amount of arable land and all the agricultural inputs that are available. Now, what's interesting is that over the last 150 years, you know, obviously the U.S. population has grown enormously, right? Corn production has gone up by a factor of 10, just due to a whole bunch of different kinds of innovations. And not only are farmers producing more corn per acre, but it's completely decoupled from acreage. So I didn't do a PowerPoint. There's a graph that shows this, and I can get you the link if you want to see it. I didn't have time to like go and get permission to use the graph and all this, but it's a graph of corn production compared to acreage. Okay, and you see that for the first decades of U.S. farm production, the amount of corn is pretty linked, pretty correlated with how much acreage of arable land we're using. And then at a certain point, they just separate. And what's happened is American farmers, this is a quote from a scientist at Rockefeller University, we've quintupled corn production using the same amount of land or even less land. We're using less land and we're producing five times the amount of corn. And it's not just land, it's other inputs as well, fertilizer, nitrogen, other things that go into corn production. You know, they went up for a while and they're actually decreasing now. And this is just purely a result of technology, agricultural methods, innovations, you know, genetically modified technology. So our ability to produce is completely decoupled from the supposed limits of nature. And this is not an unusual phenomenon. If you multiply this across other industries, across other fields, you know, I think this is why this whole perspective that we're like these bacteria in a test tube is just completely wrong. By applying reason, by innovating, specialization, trade, the division of labor on a free market, we can actually transcend the limits of nature. And there are other market phenomena, you know, so this concept of decoupling is one example. There are other things that I could talk about. I see that I'm going, I said I was going to talk for 25 minutes and I already have and I'm not done yet. So let me skip ahead a little bit. But there are other examples of this kind of phenomenon. So if we ask the question of why, you know, why did Ehrlich get it so wrong? It's he's overlooking this kind of phenomenon. He's overlooking other examples of free market incentives that drive our ability to produce beyond what one might think is possible. So one of Paul Ehrlich's most insightful critics was an economist named Julian Simon. And he had a book called The Ultimate Resource. And he called it that because his view was that the human mind, the ultimate resource is the human mind. You know, so we're not constrained by the resources of nature. You know, what the ultimate resource is the mind. And as long as we leave people free to think and to innovate and to profit from their innovations, you know, we don't have to worry about these kinds of things. Now, why would somebody so why is it that somebody like Ehrlich would ignore these kinds of factors and these kinds of processes and these kinds of phenomena? Well, let's make a kind of deeper integration and look at the philosophic perspective that this kind of worldview grows out of. So Ayn Rand pointed out, when Ayn Rand took a look at the environmentalist movement, and this was very early on. I mean, she wrote about the environmentalist movement in the early 1970s, when the movement was sort of just barely getting going. But her analysis of it was very prescient and very, you know, I mean, not surprisingly, it was right on point. She saw the environmentalist movement as an outgrowth of the whole trend of the whole anti-capitalist left, you know, through the whole 20th century. I think if you're interested in looking at her view, I think the two most important articles to look at are The Anti-Industrial Revolution, which is her talk about specifically on the environmentalist movement. But the other article to look at is an article called The New Left, which is in the same collection. It's her perspective on how the whole leftist liberal ideology evolved over the 20th century. So basically, these doomsday predictions, if part of the failure is to understand the forces of capitalism and how they lead to human flourishing and the improvement in quality of life, part of the reason for that is that they grow out of this whole anti-capitalist perspective in the first place. It's not just a blindness to how market forces work. It's an animus against capitalism. So this is part of the reason why the Ehrlichs of the world have been so wrong in the past. But I think as the last thing that I want to do is I want to just get one level deeper and try to understand what is the ideology behind the environmentalist movement. Because I think that's also, you can also see that operative in all these doomsday scenarios that we're presented with. So, I mean, another one of Ayn Rand's insights is that just the idea that ideas drive history and that basic premises are the important factor. So, instead of looking at all these different environmentalist claims as kind of separate, isolated issues, objectivism teaches us to try to understand what are the fundamental principles that are operative. So it's important to understand that environmentalism is an ideological movement. And I don't mean that in a pejorative way. I mean, objectivism is an ideological movement. Ideology just refers to philosophy insofar as there's sort of a political agenda associated with it. So what are some of the ideological premises underlying environmentalism? Now this, again, I think is... It's another place where you really have to connect the dots, because it's very easy to take the claims that that representatives of the environmentalist movement make and to just sort of take them at face value and to understand whether these claims are accurate or not, you really have to connect the dots between lots of different things. So when people talk about environmentalism, you know, the standard view that most of us have in the culture about it is to view it as a positive movement. I mean, we view it as a movement whose goal is to clean up the environment so that people can continue to live in this world and flourish and to have a safe, clean environment. Now, you know, most of you aren't prone to that kind of view, but this is the perspective that people have. So how do you dislodge that view? Is that really what the environmentalist movement is about or not? And if it's not, how do you show that it's not, right? Well, the way to show that it's not the actual view that is underlying, the actual premise that's underlying the movement, is to show that there's a certain contradiction that you see. So if it were really true that this was the goal of the environmentalist movement, was the furtherance of human life, then you would see a very different set of behaviors from the environmentalist movement when it comes to all these specific concrete issues. I think, to me, the best example of this is when it comes to issues like energy. So we're told that in order to prevent catastrophic climate change, we have to stop releasing carbon dioxide. We have to build, we have to switch to solar and wind and non-carbon producing sources, right? And so you have all these, so what ends up happening is you have all these examples of planned, you know, the one concrete example that really stood out for me was there was a project to build a solar energy facility in the Mojave Desert. And actually, if you drive from Southern California, where we live, out to Las Vegas, you see this huge solar facility that they ended up building there. When this was being planned and discussed, you know, it was presented as this is, you know, the environmentalist movement telling us this is what we need to do to, save the world from this catastrophe that we're facing, right? But what's interesting is when this planned development was underway, who were the first people, you know, on the front lines protesting against this facility? I mean, it wasn't, you know, the fossil fuel industry saying, no, don't do that. It was the environmentalists, right? How can you, you know, invade the habitat of the desert tortoise, right? How can you put an industrial development on the pristine desert, right? So now, if it were true that the goal was really to preserve and protect human life and further human flourishing, this is a contradiction, right? And what it reveals is the deeper premise that's really underlying the movement, which is, it's not about protecting human life, it's about preventing any kind of impact on nature. And I think that's the important point to bring out. I think Alex, this is the way he likes to reframe this sort of thing. It's not about, is your standard that you're trying to promote human flourishing, or is the standard that you're trying to prevent having an impact on nature? And I think if you go and you look at all these examples of doomsday claims that we've seen in the past, you know, and you really explore the claims that were made, you know, the evidence that's behind them, and the kind of policy prescriptions that are made on the basis of them, what you find is that these are the kinds of premises that are underlying them. It's not about promoting human life and promoting human flourishing. It's about stopping human beings from having any kind of impact on nature. Now, the only way you can get to this kind of view is through a lot of very wide-ranging and very deep kinds of integrations. You can't just look at these issues in isolation one at a time. You've got to look at claims that are made. You know, you've got to track the history of this one solar development over 6 years, you know, and see the contradictions emerging. And you've got to be able to put these things together to point out that they are contradictions, right? So it requires taking a very broad and a broad perspective and really bringing your knowledge of philosophy to bear in order to point these kinds of things out. So that's the kind of thinking that's required in order to reach these kinds of conclusions. So, okay. So just to wrap up, that's what I think is required in order to get a more kind of sober and rational perspective on the climate issue. If you look at it not just as a kind of unique, unprecedented issue that people are just talking about today, but rather you take a step back and you see it as an expression of a long historical progression, okay? And it's a long historical progression that has a lot of really bad premises and really bad thinking behind it. And that really bad thinking and those really bad premises, you know, have led to similar apocalyptic predictions in the past, you know, that were completely wrong, and they were wrong because of the bad thinking and the bad premises underlying them. You know, once you go through that kind of thinking process, you can come back to the present and you can look at the kinds of claims that people are making today and, you know, breathe a little more easily. It's probably not the case that the world is going to end in 12 years if we don't, you know, completely destroy our energy economy by shutting down all use of fossil fuels. In fact, if we did that, you know, the world would end in 12 years if we did what they want us to do, rather than the opposite. So let me draw a line there and we can move to discussion. So. Bennett.
You mentioned that you have other examples of decoupling or production surpassing the limits of nature.
Well, it wasn't more examples of decoupling. It was examples of other market forces at play. So actually, one thing I wanted to say is just yesterday in our journal, New Ideal, I have an article, which is actually, it's partly a book review of a book that actually, it does a good job of doing this kind of integrating that I've been recommending. The author is not an objectivist, but he's very good on these issues. You can find some of this stuff in the article that just came out. Are you all subscribed to our journal, New Ideal? If you're not, you know, get out your phone and sign up right away because there's a lot of good stuff there. Some of the other kinds of market forces that I go into have to do with things like substitution. This is one example. So, you know, what's important is not necessarily how we use a particular resource and whether that resource is going to be available to us in the future. It's the service that we get from that resource. So, you know, we need to heat our homes in the winter right? But it doesn't really matter what fuel source we use, just as long as it's clean, efficient, inexpensive, right? And so you often see in the history of technology, you see, you know, different materials being substituted for other materials. So, you know, on the bacteria premise, you have this idea that, well, you know, if we run out of, you know, wood for burning our home, let's say we're in the 19th century and we're using firewood to heat our homes. Well, if we clear all the forests, you know, we're going to run out of wood and then we're all going to freeze to death, right? Well, no. You know, we don't use wood to heat our homes anymore. We use natural gas or other sources. And this is part of the reason why forest acreage is increasing, because we don't have to chop down all the trees to heat our homes. So substitution is another kind of market force that you see that helps us transcend the limits of nature. Maybe it's true that we run out of some particular resource, but no one particular material or resource in isolation is absolutely critical. We can always innovate and find new ways to do things. Another thing that I thought was really interesting about the book that I reviewed, even the question of pollution, there's definitely an argument that environmentalists make that, you know, the only reason we were able to clean up a lot of pollution is because of environmental regulations that were passed. And one of the things this author has done a lot of research into, the author of the book is a guy named Pierre Desrochers. He's a professor at University of Toronto. And Pierre, P-I-E-R-R-E, Desrochers, D-E-S-R-O-C-H-E-R-S. It's French. All right. The book is called Population Bombed, which is like a play on the Paul Ehrlich's title. But again, go to newideal.aynrand.org and you can read my review and all the information is in there. So one of the things that he's done a lot of research into is the history of the kind of market incentives that have driven reductions in pollution. And so what he's found is that, you know, if you take the oil industry, when people first started drilling for oil, you know, it was primarily used for kerosene for illumination, right? It was used as a source of light. And, you know, they'd throw away half the battle. They just dump it in rivers. I mean, a lot of the useful stuff that we use today, they were just dumping it out. And, you know, what is it that prompted them to start to look at those, you know, waste products and try to see if they could find, you know, uses for them? It wasn't environmental regulations. It was, well, can we extract more wealth out of this? And you've got this highly competitive industry. Any little marginal profit that you can make by innovate, like by figuring out, well, there's this sludge left over in the bottom of the barrel. Can we do anything with that? You know, the person who figures out how to make that extra profit from the sludge is going to do better than his competitors. And so he looks at this across all kinds of industries, even, you know, the meatpacking industry in Chicago and, you know, various industries, and finds that competition and the profit motive, you know, have done more to deal with issues related to pollution, you know, than any kind of environmental regulations. So those are the kinds of things I have in mind. So substitution, decoupling, you know, the profit incentives driving reductions in pollution. These are far more powerful forces than the kinds of things that environmentalists want us to adopt.
The environmentalist movement seems to have more accessible theories that most people who won't dig deep into these issues can be misled by. What can we do to combat that?
Yeah, so I think what do we need to do? We need to offer simpler kinds of explanations that change the moral narrative on the issue and that are easily graspable. So I agree with that. And I actually think that in Alex Epstein's book, The Moral Case for Fossil Fuels, that's a starting point for doing that kind of thing. And that's why I think the book has been so successful, because it just completely drops all the premises that people typically have going into this. And you know, and seizes the moral high ground and has a very different moral narrative. So I agree that that's, oh, well, okay, so there's a recommendation then. I think you'll enjoy reading that specifically from the point of view that you're worried about. John. Yeah.
It strikes me that there is an extra scientific assumption being made in regard to climate models. They assume that CO2 emissions will increase exponentially in the future. Carbon is a resource, and just like your example of the sludge at the bottom of a barrel, we could trap and use it.
Yeah, I think that's definitely true. And I mean, even going beyond the models, the assumption that there will arise trends that are not that a free market economy can't adapt to and overcome is an extra scientific assumption.
That's my point. The assumptions that carbon dioxide will increase exponentially, or that food production will only increase linearly, are not contained in the models themselves. The models only tell you that if that is what happens, then this is what will follow.
Yeah, I think that's right. I think if you really look at the history of the environmentalist movement and the claims that were made, I think you can, I didn't bring the evidence to bear today to make this point, but I think you can take one step further, and it's that they're not really interested in actually modeling what's going to happen in the future. This is a solution looking for a problem. They already know that what they want is to shut down capitalism and destroy industrial civilization, and this is a rationalization for doing that. Now again, I didn't bring the evidence to bear to make that point, but I think if you spend a lot of time looking at the claims and analyzing the arguments, you know, this is something that really comes out. So it's not just extra scientific assumptions, it's extra scientific goals and premises at play here. So yeah, but I agree with your point. I'm sorry, I wasn't keeping track of who was first, so I'll just try to get to everybody. Go ahead.
One assumption of the climate alarmists is that carbon dioxide is the driver of climate change. And this is an insane idea. It's absolutely crazy.
I mean, I don't think it's crazy. I mean, I don't think it's insane. I mean, it's...
It's profoundly mistaken. CO2 levels have been much higher on Earth, and in the last 150 million years have been trending down. At 150 parts per million, plant life begins to die. We got as low as 180 parts per million before humans began to use fossil fuels. That kind of thinking needs to be made loud and clear.
No, I mean, well, there's a few things you could say, though. Like, so you're talking about a perspective that's going back 150 million years, right? The thing is, when you start to get into the weeds, I mean, if you look, like, you really need to look at the arguments on both sides, and you can't just sort of take the arguments from one school and not see how the other side would respond, because what the climate people would say is that 150 million years in a certain way is too long, because human civilization has adapted to the climate conditions that have existed for the last, say, 10,000 years. And in that period of time, you know, atmospheric levels of carbon dioxide have been fairly stable. And so that's why, you know, if it might have been 1,500 parts per million 150 million years ago, that's not relevant to what we're looking at today. So, but I think the other point I completely agree with, there's definitely the phenomenon of looking at all the, I mean, this is something that Alex talked about in his talk, looking at all the costs and none of the benefits. I mean, the greening of the Earth in the last decades because of rising carbon dioxide levels is huge. I mean, it's well documented, just the some of these improvements in agriculture that we've been seeing in the last few decades are partly driven by the increased levels of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere. And so, you know, and that's not something that Greta Thunberg talks about. So, yeah.
You talked about previous alarmist claims and how there was this unforeseen revolution in food production. I believe that similarly, innovations in technology will solve any issues resulting from climate change. Is there any evidence that these alarmist claims are encouraging people to go into the sciences and create these innovations? Or is it the free market and profit that's driving innovation?
Well, that's a good question, because I think that it's not necessarily the alarmism or the environmentalist ideas. Like, if you look at the case of Norman Borlaug, so some of the data that Paul Ehrlich was looking at, you know, was genuine. I mean, he was, you know, there was genuine data behind it. If you look at population growth and if you look at food production in countries around the world, you know, it's true that third world countries in the 1940s, 50s, 60s were struggling with food production. And I think Norman Borlaug was looking at that same phenomenon, and that was partly what motivated him to go into that field of research and to do the work that he did. But the point is, Borlaug looks at that and sees an opportunity to innovate and encourage entrepreneurship. Paul Ehrlich looks at that and sees an opportunity to attack capitalism and destroy the world. So, you know, I would hesitate to say that there's, if part of the implication is there something useful that can come out of that environmentalist perspective in that it might encourage. I think the answer is no. I think the facts are going to be out there. If there are opportunities to improve human life, you don't need to have a perspective that says that man is a parasite on the earth, you know, and needs to be stopped in order to bring that to bear and look for those opportunities. So that's the way I would answer that. Yeah. Carlos, you've had your hand up for a while.
If the green movement is an ideological movement, and ideology comes from a view of reality and a view of man's nature, what is the view of man's nature and of reality that the Greens come from in order to posit their position?
I mean, like everything else, ultimately, I think it's another form of secularized religion. And it grows out of the leftist, almost Marxist perspective that is a secularized form of Christianity. You know, it's a form of original sin. Our very existence is a sin against nature. And if we do anything, you know, if we evil sinners do anything to dare to improve our lives, you know, it has to bring about some kind of apocalyptic catastrophe. You know, if you go take a look at the anti-industrial revolution, because Ayn Rand brings out a point like this very well in there, it's you know, don't tamper with the unknowable mystical forces of nature, right? Or she's going to strike back at you. I mean, when I read Rachel Carson's book, Silent Spring, which is one of, you know, she's like the patron saint of environmentalism. This is about pesticides and DDT. It's striking that she actually uses this kind of language, you know, that if we tamper with the powerful forces of nature, nature is going to strike back. And so, you know, it's a form of it's a form of like original sin, and then, you know, the kind of the apocalyptic predictions that you get in Christianity, like God's wrath will descend upon us, and so nature is going to fight back if we tamper with her in these ways. So that there is a real that kind of metaphysical perspective that you get in environmentalism. Oh, really? Okay, well, I'll be around if anyone wants to stop me afterwards. Thank you.
Thanks for listening to the Ayn Rand Institute Live podcast. Subscribe on iTunes, Stitcher, or wherever you listen. You can also find us on YouTube. If you like this content, please share or leave us a review. For more information, go to AynRand.org.